Welcome to the AI and Faith podcast. We are a community of expert technologists, professionals, and faith leaders bringing the ancient wisdom of the world's major religions to the ethics of artificial intelligence. Join us on this new journey and welcome to the conversation.
It's hard for people to grasp this concept of, you know, what Sharia is, because they think of Sharia as being this rigid body of law that's contained in a book that's more than 1500 years old. But actually, Sharia itself includes custom. And by including custom, what we're talking about here is including the best of the collective human experience. And then what have people learned about how to regulate a specific technology? What have people learned about how to regulate AI? What have people learned about how to regulate television and other types of entertainment? All that becomes a source of the Sharia.
My name is Pablo Andrés Ruiz Salmones, and I will be your podcast host. Today's episode is from a conversation with our expert Saladin Dunn, recorded in June 2026. During this episode, we discussed how Sharia law and its related principles can function as legal frameworks for the development of modern AI systems. By examining how these frameworks were applied when earlier technologies emerged, such as television, we explore possible paths that may guide us through these uncertain times. Listen now to our conversation.
Thank you, Salah, so much for joining us. It's a pleasure and an honor to have you here.
It's my pleasure, Pablo. Good morning, everyone. Hello, everyone.
Let me read a short bio of Salah for those of you who might not be as familiar with him. Saladin Dunn is a lawyer and business executive in the technology, media, and telecommunications sectors. Salah has an extensive background in intellectual property, technology and content licensing, asset management, international business transaction, and technology policy. Salah is admitted to the State Bar of California and to the Washington State Bar Association. Salah is also a certified Sharia advisor and auditor fellow. Through his US-based law practice, Salah advises on technology transactions and investments. He's also senior advisor and until recently managing director at GQG Partners, a boutique investment firm with over 160 billion AUM focused on global and emerging market equities. Salah is also an associate professor of law at Kuwait International Law School. Previously, Salah was director of intellectual property and licensing at Microsoft Corporation at its US headquarters. Salah has also served as general counsel at various technology companies and also served on various nonprofit boards. And currently, he is a board member at HADI, the California-based nonprofit, which runs Islamic City and Chat ILM. Well, it's a very long bio, and certainly Salah has a very extensive background. And in fact, Salah and I have talked previously on different things, of the things that we're going to talk about in today's salon. If we want to start talking about our topic today, which is AI and Islam law, a practical approach, I think it would be useful for everyone to be on the same page. If you could tell us a bit of these principles about the Islamic law and the Sharia law that you and I discussed, I think would be wonderful so that everyone is on the same page, so that these principles that might be precisely relevant to all this conversation that we're having today.
Yeah, wonderful. So since we're talking about Islam, I'll start with Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim, in the name of God, the Compassionate, the Merciful. This is how we start everything that we do, whether it's professional or personal or spiritual or otherwise. It's really a pleasure to be here and to be talking about this topic. Yeah, of course, I think it's important to lay some foundational background when we're talking about the Sharia, just because there's just so much confusion about the topic and a lot of misconceptions about it. And maybe before, Pablo, if you're okay, maybe before I go into some definitions here, maybe I can talk about why this would be relevant, like where does the Sharia apply and where it doesn't.
Yeah, please go ahead. Yeah.
So when we're talking about the Sharia, people immediately think about this body of law. And you know, we'll talk a little bit about definitions and clarify what they are. And the first question is, well, where is this applicable? Like where, you know, where, if we're talking about Sharia, why, who are, you know, who's enforcing it, what are the courts that are adjudicating it, etc. And I just want to say that a really fundamental issue to understand is that the Sharia is really a pervasive part of a Muslim's life, because the Sharia, and, you know, talk a little bit more about this, you know, includes ethics, it includes spirituality, it includes legal aspects, it includes areas of worship, all sorts of aspects of a Muslim's life. So even though the applicability of Sharia varies from country to country, from almost zero applicability to more enforcement, for a Muslim, there is plenty of opportunity to apply the Sharia in one's life. So let's quickly talk about some definitions here. There are three definitions that I would leave you with just for the purpose of this conversation. So the first one is Sharia. What is it that we mean when we talk about Sharia? Sharia, linguistically, it means the path, kind of like the roadway, the path. And it's the path that leads towards God. And it is comprised of the revelations that Prophet Muhammad received from God through the angel Gabriel. So when we're talking about Sharia, we mean the Quran, the revelation that was descended upon the Prophet Muhammad. And we mean the prophetic traditions. So the statements of Prophet Muhammad, his various teachings, his judicial rulings, and his actions as understood by those who were closest to him, the members of his household and his companions and people, the early followers of Islam. So as such, because it's everything in the Quran, if any of you have ever picked up a copy of the Quran, if you haven't, I highly recommend it. You will find that it talks about all sorts of things, from issues of morality and spirituality to stories of previous prophets to areas of law to areas of contract to everything. And just as the Quran is diversified and broad, so is the Sharia, very, very broad and very diversified. The second definition that I think is important, it's spelled F-I-Q-H, fiqh. It's a little bit harder because, you know, two consonants at the end there. But fiqh is essentially the collection of judicial opinions, the collection of interpretations of legal aspects of the Sharia. So really, when people say Sharia, they really mean fiqh. They don't mean Sharia. They mean fiqh, that body of law, that collection of law. And it's I say it's law, but it's more of the interpretation of the law, because the law is available in the Quran, the law is available in the prophetic tradition. But what you have there is the interpretation of the Quran and of the prophetic tradition by generations and generations of scholars. And fiqh is essentially has different flavors to it, just because there's just a tremendous amount of diversity in Islam. And because of that diversity, you will find that fiqh is highly diversified. It's diversified by schools of thought. It's diversified by sect, for instance, Shia versus Sunni versus, you know, Ismaili, etc. And it's diversified also based on geography. So you will find that there are bodies of law that developed that are specific to a particular community that follows a specific sect of Islam. So that's the second definition. And the third definition is fatwa. Fatwa, F-A-T-W-A, I suppose. So a fatwa is essentially a judicial ruling. It's not a court judgment, but it's you can think of it more as an advisory opinion. So the question could be, what does Islam say about particular banking transaction, for instance, and the result of that, the response to that, would be called a fatwa or an advisory opinion. And so, fatwa is done either individually; somebody could ask a specific scholar of Islam, or it's done collectively. There are bodies of scholars that issue fatwas. So, here in North America, we have the Fiqh Council of North America, which is a judicial body of scholars, and they respond to inquiries that they get from various people.
Thank you so much, Salah. I think that was certainly a great introduction, because a part of the idea of today is that many times during these salons, we discuss like how different views should be applied on AI. And part of the topic today and part of the things that you and I have discussed previously is how it's currently being applied and how it also has been applied throughout history in other technologies, for example, right? And in previous technologies. So I think that perhaps to arrive to how it's being applied today, perhaps you can guide us through a bit of history of how other technologies in the past have applied these different concepts. I think that that would be very helpful to better understand where we are at today.
Yeah, that's actually a great way to talk about the various topics that kind of arise when you're examining a new area of technology or new development that impacts society just as much as AI has impacted. This maybe gives me a chance to back up a little bit. When we're talking about the Sharia and about fiqh, we said that the two main sources of the Sharia are the Quran and the prophetic tradition. Now, what happens when you're faced with a situation where the Quran is silent about a particular point or the prophetic tradition is silent about a particular point? Now, obviously, there's nothing in the Quran or in the prophetic tradition about AI, but the same could be said about various advances in technology before that have had such an impact. I'll give an example from kind of personal example from early on in my career as a lawyer. When you said my bio is long, that was a euphemism for me being old. And so, so early on in my career, after I finished my law degree in the US and practiced a little bit in the Bay Area, in the area of technology law, I went and I studied Islamic law. I did a graduate program in Islamic law in Malaysia. And armed with a degree in Sharia and Islamic law, I went to Saudi Arabia thinking I was going to go and practice Islamic law and learn more about the law. And I ended up working for a company that had a very diversified conglomerate. And one of the projects that they had me working on is one related to the introduction of a satellite TV and radio network. So mostly satellite TV, premium pay TV that was being introduced for the first time in the Gulf. And for a very broad region, this is satellite. So it covers all of the Middle East, all of North Africa, and parts of South Asia. This was at a time where in Saudi Arabia, for instance, there were only two TV channels, Channel 1 and Channel 2. And Channel 1 had mostly Quran and documentaries and things like that. And Channel 2 had just reruns of old TV shows, and it was extremely boring. And so here, all of a sudden, this group wanted to bring a satellite TV network and bring all sorts of different programming to the masses in Saudi Arabia and in other places. And of course, when this was coming, it wasn't the first satellite TV system there. These systems were being sold surreptitiously in the market, and people would just simply buy a dish and they will point it up and it will bring all sorts of programming. And so there was a street in Riyadh. It was called Iblis Street, the street of the devil, because on that street, you can walk into a shop and you can buy a satellite dish and you can buy a decoder. And with that satellite dish, you can point it towards Eurostar, for instance, a European satellite broadcasting all sorts of, you get all sorts of European programming, and all of a sudden you're watching TV from France and Spain and other places. Anyway, so this group that I worked for wanted to bring this set premium pay TV model. And already in Saudi Arabia, the scholars were very, very, and the some certain aspects of the population were already very uptight about the introduction of these satellite TV systems. And there were fatwas, there were these judicial and scholarly pronouncements that stated that owning a satellite dish was haram. Haram means prohibited. So there are these fatwas that said it was prohibited to actually own a satellite dish. So all of a sudden, you have a technology, and this technology is being judged in accordance with the various divisions in Islamic law as to the levels of permissibility of something, from something being obligatory to something being absolutely prohibited. So I was proud of the work we're doing, because the network and the group I worked for wanted to bring quality programming. It wasn't going to be just, whatever was being broadcast up in the air. And they were very prominent people. In fact, they were members of the royal family. And there was a big push to say that what we're bringing here is not random. It's not going to be harmful. It's actually going to be good. And there was a big push to counter the voices that were being heard from these various traditionalists and people who you could say were conservative religious people. When the network was launched, one of the first movies that they showed there, and this is very embarrassing because I actually worked on it, but one of the, I didn't work on the movie, obviously, but I mean, I worked for the network, but one of the first movies they showed was Basic Instinct. And if any of you are old enough to remember Basic Instinct, that was a very daring movie, if you say. And they also showed the European version of basic instinct, which lacked even some of the American safeguards that they had in the theater. So all of these people that, you know, so they were working so hard to counter all these voices, you know, of people who are saying, no, don't own a satellite TV because that will bring bad things to you and bad things to your home. And as if to prove their point, they show Basic Instinct as one of the first movies on that. All right. So, you know, it's an example of what happens when you have a new technology. And if you go to Saudi Arabia today, or I mean, I do quite a bit of business in the Gulf, and you go there and there's no dearth of entertainment options over there through satellite TV, mostly different satellite TV programming. And you can get everything from kind of religious conservative programming all the way to very, very daring, if not extremely offensive programming. And this kind of makes the point that, you know, when you're looking at the advent of technology, you know, there will be calls, there will be pushes to look at that technology and examine that technology from a classical Sharia or Islamic law perspective, but that the impact of society can be completely unpredictable. And satellite TV has had a very, very profound impact on society in the Gulf. And not all of it, based on the example I gave you, not all of it was positive, as you can probably imagine.
I think that whenever a new technology comes in, and many times the different frames or the frameworks that we have, as you're saying, do not provide a specific guide, you know, on that particular technology. And I think that not just from the Sharia law perspective, but from humanity perspective in general, when something new comes in, then we kind of have to look for, you know, trying to adapt the things, the frameworks that we have. And many times we have to say, well, it doesn't come with an instruction manual, right? On how to run this, on how to do this, or what should we do with this? Now, the next question that I'd like to ask you is, what can we actually learn from this different historic, particularly this one that you mentioned about TV and others as well? What can we learn about that that might give us a hint on how we should approach this debate on AI from the Sharia law perspective? And how is it already being applied in some cases?
Salah. Yeah, so I think, I mean, this kind of takes us back to the discussion of jurisprudence as to, okay, how do you deal, I mean, how would Islamic law, how would the Sharia deal with these advances that were not covered or were not in any way dealt with in the Islamic text, in the foundational text of Islam? And so the framework that's left in the Sharia for dealing with these novel issues, if you will, and sometimes it's old issues, but they're applied in a different context. So it's not always novelty in the sense that the topic itself is novel or the technology itself is novel. It's novelty on the impact that it has and on the effect that it has. So I said the scholars look at the Quran and this prophetic tradition. And when you read the Quran, you'll find that it talks in very, very general, very broad terms. So even the discussions of Quran on issues that we can think of, and trained as a lawyer, I think of it as a contract law issue. But the Quran deals with it in very broad principles and in more of an ethical way than it does in, you know, lawyers would be used to as a legal way. So what are the sources then of what do the scholars look at, those who issue these fatwa, whether they are collective bodies or individuals? What are the sources that they look at to understand what the Sharia is about and how fiqh would deal with a specific issue? So one of the sources of law, if you would, is this general category of public benefit. Like, what is it, and how does this advent, this new technology you have, how does it impact, what kind of benefit does it bring to society? Also, what kind of harm does it bring to society? So we talked about satellite TV as an example. You know, there are some benefits, obviously. I mean, there's a greater opportunity to share knowledge. Not every movie needs to be as racy as the one that I had mentioned, and then some could be very instructive, and you know, there's opportunity to share a lot of knowledge, whether it's on TV or through the internet, of course, and through AI. And we'll talk a little bit about how AI has impacted the way that people learn about Islam and the way that people look at Islam. So public benefit is one of the sources of Sharia. And when people look at public benefit, they look at what are the purposes of the Sharia and how does this whether it's a technology or whatever, or a particular use of this technology, how does it advance those higher benefits or higher purposes of the Sharia? These higher purposes of the Sharia are mentioned in some of the prophetic traditions, and they're mentioned in the Quran, and they're basically been narrowed down by scholars who have looked at these sacred texts and said that, you know, the purposes, the higher purposes of the Sharia are to advance and preserve five things. So the five things, one, the first one is faith. And that's one's relationship with God. This is why Islam and the Sharia has so many rulings having to do with the practice of one's religion. So all the rules about fasting and praying, all of that, they're under this umbrella of advancing and preserving the faith. So this is the first one. The second one is life itself. And so all of the rulings in Islam against murder, for instance, against suicide, against harming people or putting people in harm's way, etc., are all things that are meant to preserve, that go around this concept of preserving, advancing, and protecting life. A third category is wealth. And that includes all sorts of property. I mean, that includes money, that includes, you know, what lawyers today look at when they think of intellectual property, things that are not, you know, tangible. This is the area that's been a primary source for the development of Islamic finance as a field, Islamic insurance, etc. The fourth area would be that of protecting the intellect. So this is why in Islam, for instance, intoxicants are prohibited. You know, you don't drink alcohol, don't do, you know, you don't deal with intoxicants in general. This is also why seeking knowledge is considered an act of worship. So somebody to study, somebody to learn, advance in their field, you know, do graduate work, do field, do research on their own. All of that, this is considered an act of worship in Islam because it's one of the higher purposes of Sharia. And then the fifth one is a bit harder to understand maybe in English, but think of it as the protection of lineage or honor. And these are all the things relating to marriage, relating to adultery, relating to inheritance, relating to things that go towards the propagation of population. So these are the five higher principles of Sharia. There are some modern studies that have said, well, you can go from five to maybe a greater number. And some have added things like general liberty as one of the purposes, the protection of liberty. Others have looked at and said justice is one of the higher purposes because there are so many rulings and so many statements that have to do with justice. Anyway, so let's use these five as an example. These five higher purposes are the ones that the people issuing a fatwa would look at to determine whether something is in the benefit of society or not, and to do that benefit. Another source of Sharia is custom. What's customary in that particular land? What's customary in that particular field? What's customary in that particular industry? So custom, all of a sudden, is one of the sources of Sharia. And so this is why it's hard for people to grasp this concept of, you know, what Sharia is, because they think of Sharia as being this rigid body of law that's contained in a book that's more than 1500 years old. But actually, Sharia itself includes custom. And by including custom, what we're talking about here is including the best of the collective human experience. And then what have people learned about how to regulate a specific technology? What have people learned about how to regulate AI? What have people learned about how to regulate television and other types of entertainment? All that becomes a source of the Sharia. Another source of Sharia is analogy. Like, how do you go from a very specific prohibition, for instance, in the Quran about khamr, which is, you know, a type of intoxicant that people, you know, used to drink, to saying that all intoxicants are prohibited? How do you deal with, you know, Molly and, you know, different pills and different things and different, you know, signature, you know, different drugs and different types of, you know, cognac and different types of drinks? How do you deal with that? And that's because people apply analogy and they analogize things. So I think analogy is a hugely important one, and it's one where people, scholars would look at in examining the advent of AI and how to regulate. I'll just add just a few additional sources of Sharia. The other sources would be the laws provided in previous scriptures. So that would be considered a source of the Sharia, although for the purposes of looking at AI, the public benefit, the benefit type analysis is highly important. The customary practice is highly important, and the analogy is highly important.
Just to summarize, you mentioned the advancement of faith, life itself, wealth and property, protecting the intellect, and protection of lineage, honor, or inheritance, and all these concepts. What is your view on these five issues within the public benefit and how AI is having an impact on this? Because I think that certainly with every new technology, we all hope that technology is going to be here to, well, help make our lives better, right? I'm obviously being very broad about all this, but we all hope that's to be the case. And there certainly is, all these salons serve as evidence to that, well, there's a lot of discussion on that, right? Otherwise, we wouldn't be talking about this. So what is your view on each of these different 5 points regarding the public benefit of AI?
Let me show you, do a little bit of show and tell here. Let me show you what's a reference that I used in preparing for this. I'm holding my hand, very, very old book here. It's a 1911 print. It's not in very good shape, as you can tell. But this is a book written by a great-grandfather of mine. And this great-grandfather was a scholar of Islam, was addressing a question that was novel at the time. So the book was printed in 1911. He wrote it maybe a decade earlier than that. And the question that was being asked of him and other scholars is, could a judge rely on information that was received and that was conveyed through a telegraph? So the specific example here was, people in Beirut would be out in a hilltop trying to determine whether the moon has, the crescent is visible, to determine whether the month of Ramadan has started or not for the purpose of fasting. They do see the moon. If these people, they go to a judge and they say, we did see the moon, and they testify to that. That's it. Everybody in that place has to fast. Everybody is obligated to start the fast of Ramadan. What if these same people send a telegram from Beirut to Baghdad saying the moon was sighted in Beirut? We saw it, you should start fasting. And the question at that time was, well, how do we know that the information that we're getting through a telegram is authentic or not? How do we know that this information is correct? If we do receive this telegram, does it mean we have to fast now all of a sudden, or do we still have to go and try to see and sight the moon itself? And I mention it because in many ways, I mean, you would think that this is just an old antiquated topic and it's very, very small. But when I read his book again, I realized that what he was dealing with is exactly what scholars would be dealing with today in looking at AI. They're looking at, okay, you have this new technology. What's the benefit of using it? Well, there's a lot of discussion in his book about, how does this benefit humanity in general? You know, what good can come out of it? There's also discussion in his book about, well, how is this analogous to previous inventions, if you will, or previous advances in technology, if you will. And one of the questions that he said is that this is no different deciding when to pray when you look at a watch, because your watch tells you now it's time for sunset, so you can pray that prayer, or now it's time for, you know, one of the different daily prayers. So he went through that analysis, he looked at the benefit of it, and he asked the question, if you don't fast because you got something by telegram, let's say you in your city, you get a telegram that says that there's an invading army, you should protect yourself. Would you take any action based on it? And will you take any kind of protective measures because you got that telegram, or would you completely ignore it? And his question was, why would that be any different than getting the information about the moon sighting? And then he asked, you know, all sorts of questions about, okay, well, what are the objections? And this is very relevant to the area of AI, because there were a lot of objections to the use of the telegram. So one of the objections were, well, you don't know who's sending it. Like, you're receiving it, but it's claimed to be from a particular person. But you don't really know that. That's one issue with the technology. Two, you don't know whether that person is trustworthy or not. Three, you don't know whether the operator of the telegraph is trustworthy or not. And four, how do you really know, how can you really trust the technology that the message that you receive is essentially the same message that was transmitted? So these are some of the questions that were asked in dealing with this. And I think, you know, in the area of AI, there are all sorts of problematic areas that that are applied in today. So you know, you have the question of hallucination. I personally done research and you know, I have experience with this where I use different agents and that agent makes up stuff and gives the wrong references from the Quran that says, oh yeah, in verse such and such in this chapter, it says this. And I like, wait a minute, no, I go to the source and like, it's not there. It's absolutely not there. So hallucination, the issues with the technology, just like people were saying, well, how do we know that the transmission is actually, you know, an accurate rendering of what was given, the issue of citations. There are other issues as well. Like I go on the internet and you'll see all sorts of images being created of things that in Islam you would not be allowed. Like, for instance, people today using various tools out there can create a video of the angel Gabriel arriving in Mecca and greeting Prophet Muhammad and providing him with the first words from the Quran, which are read. So the first word in the Quran is read. And so the first full verse of the Quran is read in the name of your Lord. So people could create a video of that happening. Well, that's problematic on so many different levels from an Islamic perspective, right? Now you have the angel now, you know, takes on these fanciful view of what angels would look like. Now you have Prophet Muhammad, who is not supposed to be represented in any kind of image, being portrayed and having a certain physical appearance. And now you have the Quran, you know, the whole process of what's something that's, you know, very holy and very sacred for Muslims, being kind of profanely dealt with in a animation or other. I mean, if you go to any mosque, you would never ever see a photo or a portrait of Prophet Muhammad or of Prophet Jesus or of Prophet Moses or other prophets of Islam. Because of that, for the purpose of today, I was thinking using that imagery is, you know, is one example that offends all sorts of things. But another example is in Islamic tradition, in the Quran, it is mentioned about there's the night journey, this journey that the Prophet Muhammad took from the sacred house in Mecca to the sacred house in Jerusalem. And the prophetic tradition tells us that when Prophet Muhammad arrived in Jerusalem, he led a prayer that involved Prophet Jesus, Prophet Moses, Prophet Abraham, and other prophets in Islam. Now imagine somebody creating a video of that, of all these different prophets. You can see why if somebody's experience with the use of AI systems that relate to Islam is something like this, they will say, well, this is absolutely prohibited. You cannot use it. And they will issue a decree saying the use of AI is haram. It's prohibited because of that type of outcome, that type of things. I mean, obviously, you know, you need to talk about, I mean, there's still no way to regulate that in any way or control that in any way. But that's part of the reason why there would be objections to this. There are other reasons, and maybe we can talk about them as we talk about how AI systems are being used today in the practice of the Islamic faith.
Precisely, as a last question, given all these different, let's call them challenges, maybe, that you just outlined right now, how is it currently being used? The technology is still there and it doesn't look like it's going anywhere, right? You cannot uninvent it all of a sudden. And as you were saying, regulating it, it's certainly tough, no? And certainly, it's certainly difficult. Both the technology itself and the access to it, it's difficult. So how is it currently being addressed, Salah, in some cases?
Yeah, the types of reactions we're seeing today when it comes to AI are really varied, but they're really no different than the types of reactions to previous types of, you know, technological advances. So one of them says, we can't trust it, let's just tell people not to use it. If they don't use it, it doesn't exist. Don't buy a TV and you will not be exposed to all sorts of garbage that's being shown on the TV. Don't use AI and you won't be exposed to that. That's one reaction. The other reaction is, Well, let's provide our own alternative reaction. So you don't like what's out there on TV today? Create an Islamic channel. You don't like what's out there on these different AI models? Let's create an Islamic AI. You know, I talk about it, it seems like with a little bit of derision, but I don't mean that, because there are attempts that are meaningful and there are attempts that are not so meaningful. So for instance, today there are certain models, LLMs, that are being trained on Islamic data, particularly in Arabic language data. So these are coming from places like Qatar with their Fanar, or the UAE with their Falcon. Or, you know, there are some other attempts at building these large models, and it's very, very expensive. It takes forever. And at the end of the day, it still relies on the same kind of data that's out there in the internet, with some additions. It's, you know, if you look at, there are also attempts to, so models, but the alternatives also include very specific tools for Islamic AI. So the nonprofit I'm involved with has two different AI tools. One is a general AI kind of chatbot agent that deals with Islamic knowledge in general, but two is a very specific agent that deals with Islamic finance. And that one is a lot more interesting to me than the general one, because it's a lot more useful. It has a lot more capabilities, and it's et cetera. So that's another way of dealing with it, is providing our own type of alternatives to it. Now, the third way of dealing with it is regulation. Let's have rules out there that say you can only use this in a particular way. You can and cannot do this. Obviously, the question is, well, who will come up with these rules, these regulations, and who will enforce them? And this is a very interesting issue with Sharia. And in every Muslim country, virtually every Muslim country, conventional banking that involves usury and other types, you know, interest and other types of things that are considered unacceptable in Islam, conventional banking is the normal and a standard way of obtaining finance in that particular country. However, for many practicing Muslims, people who want to practice their religion, they'll say, well, this is, you know, there are some aspects of it that are not acceptable to Sharia. So they look for alternatives, and they look for Islamic banking type alternatives and other structures that are more acceptable. So they are applying the Sharia, even though the government itself is not applying the Sharia, or even though the regulation itself is not applying the Sharia. So I think it's the same thing with AI and regulating AI. There will be regulations that may not be applied at the national level or level of a particular jurisdiction, but that people will want to apply in their own lives. Now, this does not exist yet. So there have been attempts. I've seen some MOUs. There are some declarations like the Riyadh Declaration, and, you know, things like that, that try to provide a framework for what the regulations would look like, but it's not applicable. So regulation is another way of dealing with it.
Salah, thank you once again so much for being here and sharing all this knowledge with us. I think it's been an extremely interesting, and you certainly gave us a lot of knowledge and a lot of paths and a lot of guidance, I think, that is much needed. So thank you so much for being here. It's greatly appreciated. It's an honor to have you here.
Thank you, Pablo. Thank you all. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to our podcast. Stay tuned to listen to more recordings and interviews with experts from around the world. In the meantime, follow and rate our podcast on your favorite podcast platform and share it with your friends. Don't forget to follow us on our social media as well. We're on LinkedIn, X, and Blue Sky. Thank you for joining us today.